From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how county conservation programs are faring in the state budget. Later, writer Temple Grandin talks about the revolution in working with autism today.
One end of it, you've got Einstein had no language until age 3, and the other end, you've got somebody that remains nonverbal and is going to have to live in a supervised living situation. And the problem is they're all called autism.
New imaging could be a game changer for people with joint replacements.
We changed the sort of physics of how we look at the process here, and in doing so, we opened up a lot of different opportunities.
And rock and roll is at the heart of Barry Whiteman's new novel, but can he listen while he writes?
I've tried, and I've thought, oh my gosh, I should really be able to do this and create while I'm listening. It just doesn't work.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening today. State legislators face heavy days of committee meetings this week, including the powerful Joint Finance Committee as it ticks its way through Governor Walker's proposed biennial budget. Michael Fields Agricultural Institute is tuned into, as its name suggests, how the final product hinders or sustains farming in Wisconsin. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bent spoke with the Institute's Associate Director of Public Policy, Bridget Holcomb. She offered mixed reviews on Joint Finance's decisions. For example, the Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin program came out better than expected, but the funding of county conservation departments remains up in the air. Holcomb explains first what county conservationists are charged with doing.
Every county has a county conservation agent, and these people are little miracle workers that we have around the state. When we talk to farmers and ask them, what do you use your county conservation staff for, we heard everything from they help me get more tax deductions, to they have helped me create a better business on my farm, to I had a major problem with erosion or runoff, and they came in and helped fix the problem.
Do you know how far back those departments date in the state?
You know, every farmer that I talk to is just treated like they have been around forever.
Something that I heard is thinking about what the role the county conservation plays in the workings of a farm really has impacts on water in a big way.
Absolutely. We make the basic assumption that farmers want to keep soil and want to keep nutrients on their farm. Sometimes they have some real technical difficulties or some problem with runoff that they need help from county conservationists for. So really, every time we're drinking a glass of water, every time we are swimming in a lake, we should be thanking a county conservationist to help or helping to keep that water clean.
It goes back to realizing where our water is coming from.
And realizing that farmers are stewards not only of the land, but of a good portion of our water, and we should be helping them any way that we can to protect those resources.
The funding of these departments has always been a combination of local and state funding, is that right?
That's correct.
My understanding is that 2 years ago, there were cuts made to conservation departments.
That's correct. Even though the legislature had set how much they wanted spent on county conservation, we had an overall budget deficit. The state didn't make as much money as it thought it did. So we had to make cuts to various programs. And the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection decided one of the places that it was going to take a big chunk of money from was county conservation.
So what we're looking at now is very different.
What we're looking at now is making those cuts permanent. Instead, I'm sorry, lapses are so difficult to explain, so hard to understand. So these are cuts that are just made for 1 year in hopes that in the next year, revenues will be up and we'll be able to return to what the legislature said they wanted to spend on all of these programs. The problem here is the legislature is now considering, do we make these one-year lapses permanent so that lower number is the starting point from now on.
So what kind of activity is going on to try to sway political opinion here?
We and a lot of other groups just started mentioning this to farmers, just started mentioning, you know, there are proposed cuts to the county conservationists. The county conservationists that you work with might not be there. The office might not be there because of these cuts. We saw an amazing response from farmers, and they started calling in, wanted to find out how they can solve this.
What's the most you can hope for coming through joint finance?
What we want and what we are hearing that farmers want is not a huge ask. We're just asking to keep county conservation funded at the level that it's always been. We just want to be able to keep all of the county conservation offices across the state open.
We're talking about an issue that should come up now in the joint finances deliberations this week, but you are celebrating success on an earlier vote in joint finance. It reversed what would have been a cut in Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin. Let's talk about that a bit.
Absolutely. Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin has a grant program that was also slated to be eliminated in this state budget. However, just last week, the Joint Finance Committee voted unanimously, 16 to nothing, to put the program back into the state budget and to help folks interested in creating the local infrastructure for local food systems to help get them some support.
Give an example of something Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin has brought to life.
Shadow Claw Creamery right in Milwaukee was a recipient. Buy Local, Buy Wisconsin grants also jump-started the Fifth Season Cooperative in Viroqua that has done so much to connect local farmers with buying institutions in the area. And it's extended as far north as the South Shore, where farmers there got together and created South Shore Meat so that folks know that they are buying from their neighbors. Another very important element of this program is that overall, this has meant economic development to the state. These grants have created and retained over 100 jobs. They've created $4 million in new sales, and they've created a 6-to-1 return on investment for the state. When we're talking about job creation and economic development, we don't have to look farther than our own farms and our own food systems.
Your organization works to try to secure the future of family farm operations, looking at innovations and food production and related businesses that, you know, keep things humming. Are there resources, financial resources, at the federal level that people can count on?
I would say that if I was a farmer right now, I would not make my decisions on how I wanted to farm and what I wanted to farm based on what the federal government or the state government was doing. What I would hope, though, is that both the state government and the federal government would be able to respond to what farmers want to do and help get them the resources that they need.
So what farmers are telling you in a nutshell is?
What I'm hearing from farmers is we are looking for new ways to farm. We need to change with the times, and we are trying, but our policies are not keeping up with us.
Bridget Holcomb is the Associate Director of Public Policy for the Michael Fields Agricultural Institute in East Troy. She spoke with WUWM's Susan Bentz. There are links to more information about county conservation departments at WUWM.com. It's a pivotal time for work in the field of autism, so says noted writer Temple Grandin, who herself is on the autism spectrum. We'll talk with her next when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The condition known as autism was not even defined in medicine until 1943. Since then, its prevalence increased steadily through the years until the 1990s, when the numbers suddenly shot up. Today, roughly one out of every 88 children born in the United States is diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. While that might sound like bleak news, Temple Grandin says there is a flip side. Grandin is one of the best-known and accomplished people with autism today. In her new book, The Autistic Brain, Grandin writes that there is a revolution underway in how we view and work with autism. Temple Grandin joins us on the line now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
You were diagnosed with autism not all that long after autism was first defined. Obviously, there were some very wrong theories about autism that have been made and discarded since then. But how much would you say, how much more confident is science today in understanding the nature of autism than it was 20, 30, 50 years ago?
They know now that it's definitely a neurological disorder. It's not psychological. No, but the problem is the diagnosis has changed over the years. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, Richard Panik and I go over the whole history of the diagnosis. Every decade or so, they changed some of the requirements. It's a behavioral profile of a certain cluster of symptoms. It's not a precise diagnosis, you know, like tuberculosis would be.
Well, and it was fascinating to see that one of the reasons that some people were diagnosed while others weren't was because of a simple typographical error in the manual.
Well, that's right. You see, and see, the DSM is probably half science, and the other half of it is doctors' opinions sitting around conference room tables.
You write in several places in this latest book about your enthusiasm for taking advantage of imaging studies on your own brain.
Yeah.
Why are you so keen to see inside your brain?
Well, I sort of like it's been very interesting for me, first of all, learning that my thinking was different. You know, when I was young, I thought everybody was a visual thinker like me. I didn't know I was different until I started interviewing people about how they think. Well, then when I found out that my thinking was different, then, of course, scientists get interested in what's going on inside. You might say exploring, basically.
Well, and it is a fascinating opportunity. How would you compare the usefulness of the imaging technology that's available and employed by scientists today versus the MRI you first underwent in 1987?
Oh, there's been huge advances in the technology compared to the one in 1987. Just huge. Those images done by Walter Snyder at the University of Pittsburgh on the high-definition diffuse intensure imaging can track white fiber bundles that connect up different departments in the brain. Basically, dissect out all the white matter interconnector circuits. And this technology was originally paid for by the Defense Department for head injuries. It has amazing potential for diagnosing autism and many other different things. But it's going to take a lot of subjects put through the scanner in order to do what's called norming the test. At what point is one of those fiber bundles abnormal?
Right, and I think you write one of the key challenges is that what is the case in one autistic brain is not necessarily the case in another autistic brain.
Now, the thing that seems to be the most universal, at least on the highly verbal people with autism, are the circuits for social face recognition circuits and circuits for recognizing facial expressions. That seems to be pretty universal in all the people that have good speech. The other stuff, like visual thinking and mathematical thinking and size of the cerebellum, the size of the fear center, like my fear center is bigger than normal, but I want to emphasize that's not on everybody. You see, all those other things are very variable.
Well, what would you think the greatest promise is for the use of these studies? It's one thing to be able to see what's going on and look at what, as you say, a broken brain actually looks like.
Well, it isn't broken because, in a head injury, you rip fiber bundles. In a developmental difference, they just grow in a different way. Okay, for example, there's different types of language problems. I had problems with getting my speech out. And the brain scans show that there were problems with the amount of bandwidth I had on the speak-what-you-see circuit. But then another kind of kid, he yaks out all these TV commercials and movie scripts, but he doesn't know what the words mean. You see, that's a different type of a problem. You see, and ultimately, some of those things could be diagnosed when the child's still nonverbal, and you change the way you do therapy for a kid that's echolalic and yaks out TV commercials compared to a kid like me that can't get the speech out.
Would this also have implications for the idea that you write about playing to an autistic person's strengths down the road?
Well, you definitely want to play to their strengths. My strength was art. Strengths often show up around 8 or 9 years old, sometimes earlier, but usually, you know, third grade or so, 8 years old. That's when my ability in art really showed up. You know, that's when ability in math will oftentimes really show up. Build on the kid's area of strength. We got way too much emphasis on deficits. You know, kids that are super good at math often have troubles with reading. You know, and obviously we got to work on reading. If we've got a third grader that's super good at math, I don't want him getting bored with baby math and becoming a behavior problem. No, if that third grader can do a sixth grade math book, then let him have the sixth grade math book. Let him have the college math book if he can do it.
Right. I think you write about your own experience in high school with a particularly remarkable teacher, but the one area that you said did not work out so well was his insistence that you have to get down algebra before you got
that
anything else.
That was a mistake. In fact, what I'm finding now and talking to lots of people is that there's individuals who cannot do algebra. They should go right to geometry and right straight to trigonometry. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I also present the scientific research that shows that the picture thinker like me and the more mathematical thinker actually are two different types of visual spatial thinking. And I've got both brain scan research and research with various paper and pencil tests that prove that these two types of thinking actually do exist. And all those references are in the book.
One of the most interesting sections, I thought, in this book revolves around the idea of sensory problems among people with autism. And first, how do you describe your own sensory problems?
Well, I have problems with touch sensitivity, with scratchy clothes. I had a lot of problems with loud noise. Then you have other individuals that can't stand fluorescent lights because they can see the flicker of fluorescent lights. And in the autistic brain, I go through the different types of sensory problems. Also have some tips on ways to adjust to those problems. But of one area I think there needs to be a lot of research on is the sensory problems, because they can range from being a nuisance to being extremely debilitating. And there are some individuals that will never be able to tolerate a noisy restaurant.
Well, and scientists have known that these sensory problems existed for a while, but why do you think they have been so under-researched or understudied?
Well, I think part of the problem is they are so variable. If you take 10 kids labeled autistic, maybe only three of them really have a bad problem with the fluorescent lights. You know, maybe there's one or two that have a problem with certain smells, but the rest don't. The sensory issues tend to be extremely variable. You know, where things like problems with the face recognition circuits, some of the social circuits, at least in the kids that are verbal, that tends to be pretty much even across the spectrum.
Well, what do you think the strategy ought to be in looking at sensory problems?
Well, you have to figure out what sensory problem the kid has and then try to do something about it. Now, when it comes to sound sensitivity, sometimes a kid can be desensitized if he initiates the sound. All right, let's take the dreaded smoke alarm. Let's take a smoke alarm, wrap it up in five towels. Then he reaches in there and turns it on where he initiates it. Then you gradually make it louder by taking towels off of it. But when the child controls the initiation of the dreaded sound, it's easier to desensitize.
As you say, I imagine one of the issues is that there is so much variability. You know, when science, when researchers deal with people with headaches, they can say, take a Tylenol or,
That's right.
But there are so many variables from one autistic person to another, it's difficult to come up with
a
blanket.
What needs to be done in terms of researching the sensory problems, and I discuss that in the autistic brain, is we're going to have to research it by the type of sensory problem a person has, because you can get these sensory problems with dyslexia, with ADHD, learning difficulties, tons of different labels, and say, okay, we'll take the people that have a problem with fluorescent lights, and we put them all together as one group, and then we have controls that don't have that problem. And you've got to study them based on what their sensory problem is.
In this book, you write about the mild Asperger types, the people who used to go through life as simply shy or geeky. Are there advantages to having the autism spectrum label, or can it be inhibiting?
I get worried with some of these smart kids with them getting held back, because you go out to Silicon Valley, I mean, half the people there are a little bit on the spectrum, and they avoid the labels like the plague. But in order to get services, you got to have the label. And the kids on the real mild end tend to get it because they don't have friends, having social problems in school. And one thing I would strongly recommend is get kids involved with shared interests. You know, if they like horses, how about ride horses? If they like electronics, they could get in a hackerspace electronics club, or be in band, or be in art classes, or cooking classes, or 4-H, or FFA, or Boy Scouts. Get them involved with things where they have a shared interest. And then often the teasing does not happen in those shared interest activities.
Well, what are the other ways that you recommend schools and parents better assist children across the autistic spectrum in preparing them to succeed after they are children?
Well, first of all, autism is a very big spectrum. I mean, at one end of it, you've got Einstein had no language until age 3, and at the other end, you've got somebody that remains nonverbal and is going to have to live in a supervised living situation. And the problem is they're all called autism. And I think it's oftentimes hard for teachers to shift gears between, you know, a kid that, you know, ought to be trained to be a scientist versus a kid that will have to live in a group home. You know, it's a very, very big spectrum.
Absolutely. Would you contend, though, that in the idea of identifying strengths, that regardless of where you are on that spectrum, there are strengths to be taken advantage of?
Usually there are strengths. You know, because you have a big moderate range where they're partially verbal, and some of those can be very good at, you know, doing jobs in an office, like, you know, running a photocopier, running the shredder, or doing some filing.
I know you are loath to predict how autism will be viewed and treated in, say, the next 60 years, but I am curious if you think science has as far to go in the next 60 years as it has since you were first diagnosed.
Well, I think in the next 10 years or so, they're going to start doing everything with brain scans. But the problem is you're going to have to norm the test. Okay, if you look at in the autistic brain book, I've got my scan for the look what you see circuit, and then we've got the scan for the normal one. Now, how many bushes does it have to have before it gets abnormal? Well, you're going to have to scan a pile of people that have been very, very clinically evaluated very carefully for language problems in order to determine when a circuit has enough bushes to become abnormal. You see, because a lot of these things are continuous. But
sure.
My speak what you see circuit, you look at the one that's in the USA Today, that's you know, that's really abnormal. It goes all over the whole brain, where the normal speak what you see circuit stops at the language areas.
Are you optimistic about where we are today and where we are likely to go?
Well, one thing I get worried about is I see too many kids getting locked into the labels. Kids come up to me and they want to tell me all about their autism. I'd rather hear about their science project or hear that they like to train dogs or they like history, you know, or they like astronomy, you know, whatever their favorite thing is.
You think kids are too eager to keep the label on themselves?
Well, they're too eager to get all, you see, autistic kids tend to get fixated on their favorite stuff. And they get way too fixated on, oh, they want to tell me all about their autism. Well, I don't really want to talk to a 22-year-old that's fully verbal about his autism. I'd rather talk about how do we get him a job that he can do that he's going to like. We need to be teaching these kids work skills, and I think that needs to start in middle school. You know, if there's a paper route around, that's great, but I know those are gone. But how about walking some dogs for some people? Or maybe buying groceries for, you know, an old lady, and every, you know, twice a week you got to buy her groceries, get her to list and buy her groceries for her. You know, there's a discipline to work that kids need to learn.
Well, yours is a remarkable story, and the book is remarkable as well. And Temple Grandin, I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, it's great to be here, and I hope you all read The Autistic Brain.
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She also lives with an autism spectrum disorder and has written several best-selling books on the subject. Her new book, written with Richard Panik, is called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. There's a link to more about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another revolution in imaging may soon be underway. We'll hear about its Milwaukee connection after a break on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we spoke with author Temple Grandin about how new imaging technologies are in the process of revolutionizing how doctors can assess autism spectrum disorders. Another development in imaging may soon change the lives of people who have joint replacements. Kevin Koch is a physicist at Waukesha-based GE Healthcare. He led an effort to rectify a significant limitation in magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs. A study on the new technique's effectiveness was just published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And Kevin Koch joins us now in the Lake Effect studio. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What were the shortcomings in imaging that you sought to address in developing this technology?
There was a lot of clinical desire to try and image around orthopedic implants. The orthopedic implants are made out of metallic materials most of the time, and they create a disturbance in the magnetic field that you use to try and do MRI in.
So you have some kind of titanium knee or shoulder or hip or whatever, and you're having issues, and it's hard to get a clear image basically.
Correct. Yeah. There's certain things we can do with the system to crank it up to try and reduce the distortion that metal causes, but there are some pretty severe limits on how much we can do with that. So when I came into the situation, we were looking at ways in which we might be able to rethink the way we collect the data to remove those distortions.
Well, and you are not an orthopedic surgeon, but how in the past have doctors been able to examine the area around it, if not for imaging?
There's been a lot of limitations on what they can do. So obviously exploratory surgery is an option there, but that's a pretty that's one of the least desirable ways to do things. Basically, just doing a physical exam and trying to get as much information as they can from that. They did try to use imaging, so you would use plain film X-ray, get what you can from that. The MRI and CT-type imaging options had a lot of artifact, though, but they would still use it and do the best they could with it. So really, there was a pretty open opportunity for coming up with a way to really clearly assess the soft tissue and the bone around these implants, and there really wasn't anything out there.
So a patient would go in and say, my knee is hurting, and I've had this knee replacement, and they would the doctor or whoever is doing the imaging would essentially try to see if there was inflammation, but they were never able to definitively say?
Correct. Yeah, there wasn't a way to definitively take a look and say, okay, I can see right next to that implant now, and yeah, I can see the inflammation there. I can see the soft tissue damage that might be causing that inflammation. There was really no way to do that.
Well, so what was it about the previous technology that made it so susceptible to these artifacts and essentially blurry images that came out?
Yeah, it was distortions in the image that really caused the problems. The reason is because the metal creates a distortion of the magnetic field, and we actually use the magnetic field to encode signal. So basically we take a volume and we use the magnetic fields and we apply some magnetic fields as well that we know what the shape of those magnetic fields are, and we use that information in order to rebuild the image. Now, when you put the metal inside the magnet and it creates these distortions, that information that we're using is now completely warped. And we don't know ahead of time usually what that warping is going to be. And so the image that comes out is severely distorted.
Well, and so then does your technology effectively put a set of glasses on the technology that exists, or is it an entirely different way of doing things?
It's an entirely different way of doing things. We really had to rethink the way that we acquire the data. And one of the ways that I like to explain it is what we used to do was sort of fight against those magnetic distortions that were there and just crank our system up and say, well, we're going to come directly against you and we're going to try and reduce the effect that you have. And what we did with this new technology is we said, okay, we acknowledged that magnetic field distortion was there, and we actually kind of let it decide what we were going to do, and then we worked around it. So instead of working directly against it, we sort of acknowledged its presence and found out a way that we could sort of work around the problems instead of going against them.
Well, what's as best as you can describe what you're doing?
Well, what we did is actually allowed the magnetic field to dictate the region of the image that we would image. And what that does is it allows us to select regions that have relatively little severity of distortion. And we do that piece by piece. So instead of trying to make an image of the whole region that has all this magnetic field distortion, we actually break it up into tiny pieces and we image each of those pieces individually. And then what we can do is take all those pieces, once we've imaged them, and put them together afterwards. So it's kind of a divide and conquer. We break it up into pieces and then put it back together.
Are there still holes in that data that you have to extrapolate, or are you really able to get a full image this way?
No, that's actually a very good question. That was the tricky thing with getting this whole thing to work, was getting the pieces to fit together nicely. And that's one of the nicest things about the approach that we came up with, is we have a very good way of filling those gaps. And we don't have to do anything to extrapolate or interpolate between these regions. We actually collect all the data and make sure we're very good at covering all of the regions, so we don't have to worry about that.
How long has this process been for you from start to today?
I was hired by GE to work on this problem specifically about 6.5 years ago. It took probably about 9 months before we had a basic concept in place here after I started. But yeah, that was a relatively low-resolution image that took a very long time to acquire. But at least the physics was somewhat worked out at that point. And then we spent a couple more years refining it and making it, you know, a little bit more clinically viable. We had some strong technical collaborators at Stanford University that we worked with. We had a clinical collaborator at Hospital for Special Surgery in New York that, you know, really helped us define how this technology needed to work to be clinically practical. So it was kind of this group of internal developers, external collaborators that refined it over the span of a few years that, you know, that resulted in something that we could really send out as a product.
What we haven't asked at this point is, I mean, you said you were hired by GE Healthcare to solve this problem, but what initiated the problem? Who first started asking for this?
Yeah, we actually had a clinical collaborator who I mentioned previously, Dr. Hollis Potter, based out of Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. And she had some vast experience trying to use MRI to look at these implants and the problems that they caused. And she had quite a bit of success despite the artifacts. And so based on that success, she went actually to all of the major MRI manufacturers and proposed to them that it would be good for them to start looking at this problem and maybe hire a physicist to work on it. And GE Healthcare was actually the only one that stepped up to the plate. And so they actually hired me to work specifically on this problem based off of the clinical need that Dr. Potter really very, very clearly laid out for them.
As a physicist, I mean, there's always, you know, there are lots of theories in physics, and there are a lot of people working with equations in physics. It must be remarkable to start with this problem 6 years ago and have this thing that actually does what it sets out to do at the end of the process.
Yeah, it is. It's fairly rare actually for us to come up with something that actually works and has a real world practical value. We throw a lot of darts. Every once in a while the darts strike the bullseye, or at least close to the bullseye. Yeah, it's nice to see something that comes out, but it does take a lot of proper evaluation and sort of decisions along the way to get to a point where you can really put something out there. I mean, we had to be very practical and make decisions and make sure we focused on the right problems in order to get it to something that would be practical, you know, for the general, you know, clinic.
In terms of that, this is very much the beginning stage, right? This is not a technology that is available all over the place at hospitals and clinics yet.
No. We are the first to market with this type of technology, and it's just now at the point where it's some pilot sites and will be available for wider distribution in a month or two.
What does this thing actually look like? How big is it? How does it work? You know, when a patient is going to be imaged using this technology, what do they have to do?
Oh, it's just a software change. There's no physical hardware that's involved in order to make this work. So really, it's the same as a conventional MRI exam. So whatever they would do now, they really wouldn't notice anything new happening. It would sound the same. You know, the MRI machines with the current technology make quite a bit of noise. I mean, it'll, you know, sound the same as a conventional MRI sequence would.
So it did not need a whole new shell to be able to do this.
It did not. No. It's just a software upgrade.
Does that mean, and I realize you're not on the marketing side of the equation, but does that mean it will be easier for this kind of thing to get to clinics and hospitals?
Very much so. Yeah, it's going to be available on a wide variety of our MRI platforms. It doesn't have a lot of constraints on what systems it can work on, because it is basically just a software change.
You're not carrying it around on a jump drive, though, are you?
I could, but I don't.
Do you look at this? Is this an objective accomplished for you, or does it remain a project that you continue to work on and perfect? Are there things that will evolve about it?
There are definitely things that will evolve. We changed the sort of physics of how we look at the process here, and in doing so, we opened up a lot of different opportunities for exploiting the signal that's coming out and doing different things with it. There are certainly going to be remaining clinical desires, branching off of this technology, and so we have line of sight on a few things right away that we're working on. But there's probably things that I or we have not even thought about yet. So I think there is going to be, quite a bit of work that can still go on.
Kevin Koch, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Kevin Koch is a physicist with GE Healthcare in Waukesha. He led a team that developed a technology called Maverick SL, which improves MRI images in patients with joint replacements and other artificial implants. A study of the technology's effectiveness was just published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. There is a link to it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then Milwaukee area writer and Lake Effect contributor Barry Whiteman stops by to chat about his new novel, playing out during a pivotal period for rock and roll. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. We've talked computer imaging technology in the last couple of Lake Effect segments. Suffice it to say that the things computers are accomplishing today were just a gleam in the eyes of Pepper Porter and Suze Frommer in the early 1970s. At least that would have been the case if Porter and Frommer were real people. But they are fictional characters at the center of Milwaukee area writer Barry Whiteman's new novel, Pepperland. The book is set at the dawning of one age, the computer revolution, and the sunset of another, an age of innocence in the rock music industry. Both of those worlds are at center stage in Pepperland, and Whiteman, who is also a Lake Effect essayist, joins us to share the story. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, Mitch, it's just great to be here. And for Pete's sake, I've got a book, and we're talking about my book. How cool is that?
That is about as exciting as it gets.
Yes, sir.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you feel like you're telling a rock and roll story overlaid with technology, or a technology story overlaid with rock and roll, or is the better word to use overdubbed?
Overdub, I like that. That's really good. Yeah, that's a good question. I think it started in my head as a rock and roll tale. But the technology thing, which is where I come from. My background is a long time in high tech, going back to the ancient era of the 70s and even the 60s. And so I think it's the technology is overlaid on it, but boy, it's really gotten into the heart of it, and that's what drives it, I think. It
would have been so much more authentic if you had written this on punch cards.
Oh, the 80-column card, yes. Oh, the deck of cards, yes. My characters, Suze and Pepper, yes, they had to live with those things. Unbelievable ancient stuff.
Let's start by addressing the title. Pepperland is the name of the band your hero, Pepper Porter, founds. It is also, if memory serves, a Beatles reference, right? Yellow Submarine?
It's an outrageous Beatles reference, yes. Yellow Submarine, the cartoon, the animation flick that was out there and never really caught on a lot, but Pepperland was where the Blue Meanies were taking over and they were being beastly to everyone, and the Beatles saved the day through love, peace, and understanding and all that. But maybe more importantly is there's a bit of music that was on the original soundtrack that was recorded for the movie. And the music is by George Martin. It's a lovely orchestral piece that I have always just loved. And so in my head, that's kind of the overture to Pepperland. It's just a lovely bit.
We ought to mention this. You included discography at the end of Pepperland. And, of course, the chapter titles in the book are all song lyrics. Do you listen to music when you write?
No, I can't do that. I've tried and I've thought, oh my gosh, I should really be able to do this and create while I'm listening. It just doesn't work. Doesn't work because I've got to be able to shut out everything, and because what I'm trying to put on the page is kind of musical in itself, and if I'm hearing other stuff that's distracting, it'll just screw it up. So it can't work.
So the music that drives the story is in your head, but it's not in your head all at the same time.
Right, and so I'll finish up an episode or something, and then I'll put on a Jefferson Airplane tune, which figures highly in this thing, and yeah, okay, that'll get me, and I can really the search for it, which is built into Pepperland. It's the it. What is it? It's the hard to describe magic, the pleasure bursts that come from anything. I mean, come from music, come from reading a book, closing a sales deal. It's that really cool feeling, that cosmic sort of ecstasy. And so, and I get that out of reading and writing and music.
It is not a stretch, I don't think, to point out. In fact, you've kind of done this already, that the two central themes of the book have both been a part of your life, computers and rock and roll. What are the other kinds of parallels you might draw between Pepper Porter and Barry Whiteman, and what are the big places where the two characters diverge?
Oh, Pepper was – he's a lot smarter than I was. he's this engineer, this computer science graduate of the University of Michigan, and he was like actually being sought out by IBM and other big computer makers of the day, and I sure as heck wasn't. So Pepper's a lot smarter than me.
As the book opens, we get a brief taste of his life in college at the turn of the 1970s. And really on the first page of the book, he meets the woman who kind of sets his life in motion, the beguiling Suze.
The beguiling Suze. Suze is brilliant, and she's the only female in the computer science department at the University of Michigan, which, by the way, was one of the best academic computer systems in the country. And so here she is. She is this incredibly talented young woman in this all-boys club, and she's having to deal with professors that are doing everything politically incorrect, and it's pretty tough on her, and she's hitting that glass ceiling. But nobody can deny that she's got it. She is smart, and she can figure things out, and she has it.
Well, and as a really early computer scientist, she, as much as anybody, sees the potential for where computers meet regular people as opposed to really what computers are being used for at the turn of the 1970s.
Exactly, because in those days, computers were just the billing machines. They were the accounting systems that generated all the invoices and stuff. But the crazies, the computer lunatics that were found in little pockets like at Michigan and out there in Stanford at Palo Alto and in Boston, other little pockets of brilliance, they were the folks that could see over the horizon that there's going to be some amazing stuff possible here. And so she has come up with this algorithm that could be part of the personal computer revolution that in 1974, when all this was most of this was taking place, was in fact being invented in some crazy labs in those places. And she has got one of the algorithms that could change the world.
And by 1974, she is very much on the lam. She has, in the
right.
intervening years,
yeah.
Joined the Weather Underground and kind of disappeared and had to reinvent herself.
Exactly. She's passionate about everything. And I think it's her lack of moderation that Pepper always sort of suspected could bring her or the both of them down. And it's kind of true because she's just – everything she does, it's all in. She did run off with the Weather Underground in 1970 because if the opening scene in the book takes place on the night before Kent State. The next day after Pepper and Suze meet, she's fully radicalized. And then later that summer, she disappears and doesn't reappear for quite some time.
How important was Suze in the creation of the book itself versus Pepper? Who was in your head first?
Well, Pepper was in my head first, but it really wasn't. It wasn't going anywhere. I've got these fun guys and following them around doing some fun stuff. But until I came up with her, it was really kind of, well, so what? You know, what do we got here? So what? Big deal. But as my wife likes to put out, she says, you need somebody. You need this girl. So, yeah, yes, you're right, dear. And so Suze appeared. And as soon as she did, story took off, and we had something there.
Tension ensues, and tension drives the thing forward.
Exactly, yeah.
One of the central metaphors of the book is entropy, which is, you know, kind of a delicious concept on its own. But what was it that made it compelling for you in bringing this story, in being kind of central to the story?
Well, first off, the word entropy, it's a gorgeous word. It's got that sort of bizarre look and feel to it, and I'm always about words that look good and sound good. You know, I came across the term, yes, in high school a million years ago in physics class with a professor who brought it up, and he entitled his little lecture, "The Day I Discovered Entropy." And what is entropy? Well, it's a slippery concept that has to do with how the universe tends to find an equilibrium, such as boiling water will eventually just cool off to a lukewarmness, you know, blandness. And so entropy in a social context could be taken, you know, a number of different ways. It could be that it's a sameness, it's a boringness, it's a blandness, and that is to be combated. Pepper and Suze, Pepper, who he's the one that brings this up, you know, he's decided that he has to combat this and have to go off and rile things up and change the world, things like that. Whereas entropy is the natural way of the universe. So it's not bad. It's just the way it is. And I'm also, when bringing up the subject of entropy, I'm kind of ripping off one of my literary heroes, Thomas Pynchon, who always seems to have a handle on that subject. And I think that in Pepperland, it's about these two characters who are trying to change the world and go against the man, rage against the machine.
As we talked about earlier in the interview, this isn't just about computers and the underground. This is also about rock and roll. Pepper has a band that starts to take off.
Accidentally, kind of amazingly.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking about the significance of the era in which the book is set. And aside from being the formative era for what would become the internet, it's also something of the end of an era for the record industry as it used to be.
It really is. This is 1974, early 70s. Just as the original promoters like Bill Graham and those kinds of folks were kind of losing control, and it was becoming a big money game, and the big money folks were starting to take over, and the concert promoters were now they're booking arenas, you know, and the stadiums, and big acts like Led Zeppelin and the Stones were playing the big places and not just the funky old Fillmore and places like that. So the little record label in Chicago that Pepperland, the band, has signed with is called Checkers Records. And Checkers Records is, you know, eventually they're probably going to get acquired by who knows who, one of the big outfits. And so, yes, it's changing, and it's unrecognizable today from what it was in the early 70s.
But fortunately, at this stage for Pepper and his bandmates, not only does Checkers Records still exist, but individual radio stations playing your song can really make a difference.
Actual DJs that spin records and know something about them and talk to the to the audience, and I mentioned in the book WLS and WVON in Chicago, and WOKY right here in Milwaukee is mentioned, and then some St. Louis stations. So, yeah, that's when radio was real. We had real jocks spinning discs. Very fun.
There are also a couple of entertaining nods to pop culture that I picked up on in this. The manager of the record store where Pepper works is named Laszlo Toth, who I believe is a Don Novello character.
Bingo!
And one of the record company's early signings is the Thamesman, which, if memory serves, was the original name for Spinal Tap.
Yes. So there are a number of obscure references. Kind of a stump the band. The book is littered with little bits like that all throughout the whole story. So.
Which I imagine was some of the fun for you.
Exactly. And sharp-eyed readers may pick up on stuff like that. Like the time in the Playboy Club where the band leaves the table where they're being wined and dined by the record company, and they're trying to find the men's room. I ripped off. Well, no, actually, Spinal Tap ripped me off. I mean, it happened to Pepperland before Spinal Tap was made. Come on.
Certainly a nice nod to Spinal Tap.
Yes,
anyway.
There you go.
Well, and so I have to ask, Pepper and the band record a couple of records that start to break through in the course of the novel. And I was wondering whether these are songs or snippets of songs you actually have in your mind.
You know, there's in my very helpful discography at the end of the book, I do list all of the songs that the fictitious band Pepperland does. And there's some really great songs in there. I mean, these are some good titles. And yeah, I have in my head, oh, that I think Freak Out in Coal City will sound kind of like that. And Burgers in Benton. It was probably this kind of song. And I've got some things worked out. But, you know, no, we're not in any danger of me playing those.
It's not an accompanying CD that is going to go with this book.
No, it's not going to happen, Mitch.
This book has been in progress for how long?
Oh, it's been about 4 years. Although my antenna started picking up the first wavelengths of it, like 10 years ago or something. But I didn't really start writing it till 4 years ago.
It must be still something to have it sitting open on the console in front of you.
Isn't that cool? I mean, there it is. It's great. It looks good. And, yeah, it's coming out, now. It's out there.
At a bookseller near you.
At a bookseller near you.
Well, Barry Whiteman, congratulations. It's a fun read, and best of luck with it.
Well, thanks, Mitch. Appreciate it.
Milwaukee writer Barry Whiteman's new novel is called Pepperland, published by Running Meter Press. Whiteman, who is also a Lake Effect essayist, will talk about the book tonight at Boswell Book Company. There is a link to much more about the book from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. George Martin's Pepperland Suite takes us out on Tuesday's show. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.